Recording.
Okay, we're official. We're on. Palm chromatography today. And the first thing that we've really got to do is try to explain how column chromatography is different than thin layer chromatography. And fortunately, it's really not any different. It's just that one is done sort of horizontal while the other one is done vertical. And in terms of thinking about chromatography, when we did TLC, so if we look at sort of putting a TLC plate into a tank and that TLC plate resting up against the side, the solvent is in here. And what we had is we had the solvent that runs up the TLC plate. And so it carries the spots up the TLC plate as the TLC plate develops. When we do column chromatography, what we do is we take a column and we apply the material to the column, and the column has a solid support material in it. And usually they also have down here a stopcock that allows us to be able to control the flow of what's going through the column. And there is some packing material that's in here, and there's different sort of layers of packing material that we put into it. So we'll just do a standard sort of gray packing material that's in here. And when we apply compound to it, the compound gets applied up at the surface, and then solvent is run through this, and it is run downwards such that the materials stratify as they're going through in bands, and you will get different materials eluting out at different times as the material passes through the column. And then you capture those into test tubes at the bottom as the material elutes off the column. So whereas a TLC plate is vertical in the upwards orientation and you're separating as you go up, column chromatography is in the downwards orientation. And also the other aspect is that when we think about doing TLC, TLC is really two-dimensional in the way in which it's being developed and on a flat surface like that. But the column chromatography is more three-dimensional. And so we need to think a little bit differently about how we apply compounds to a column and how to run that column, and how the skills that we learned in TLC translate to the skills in column chromatography. So the column chromatography is much more difficult. It's much more challenging to do, but it's also much more satisfying when you're separating out the columns, separating out the compounds. And the idea too is that TLC is really about analysis. So you're doing analysis of mixtures. In the column chromatography, we're doing separation of mixtures. There is a type of TLC that is called prep TLC. And in prep TLC, you can actually do something very much like column chromatography. In a prep TLC, a standard TLC plate looks, you know, sort of like the small standard TLC plate. And if we look at it on its side, it's very thin, so side view, and it has just a small amount of solid support material that's on that side view. This is a standard TLC. A prep TLC is a very large glass plate. And so you can imagine sort of a three-dimensional glass plate. And on this glass plate, they put a very thick layer of the solid support material. And so on top of this, there's, let's do it with that gray color, and we'll grab this guy so we can fill this all in quickly. This solid support material that's on here is a very thick coating of the solid support material. And then what you do is, rather than putting spots onto it, we have our spotting line where we would have put the material. But what we do is we use an entire pipette of material, and we put the material in a thick band at the bottom. And that thick band, then we develop it. And as we develop it, it stratifies up the glass plate, And it looks like bands of material at that point. So we would get different sort of wavy bands of material that would separate out. And then literally what you do is when you visualize the bands, you then go in with a razor blade and you cut out a section. You take it out. Oh, it took the whole thing with me. You take the section out, and then that section, you crumple it, the powder, into a beaker and dissolve it in the beaker with some solvent. And then you filter it. And once you filter it, you get just that compound, which is kind of cool. So that's called a prep TLC. And the prep TLC allows you to actually then isolate out compounds rather than just analyze compounds. But it's a whole different way of doing TLC on a much, much bigger scale. And you have to have a great big tank in order to handle these glass plates. And the glass plates can be like 8 inches by 8 inches or even bigger, depending upon how you're doing that prep TLC. So that's a little bit like column chromatography. But with the column chromatography, we're going to see that that we're isolating it directly into test tubes. And so the first thing that we need to do is we need to talk about the design of a column and the analogies with TLC and what we've done with TLC. All right, you know what? Let me get the chats up. You're right, I forget. Let's see, Rodrigo, do you need to finish like finish line like in TLC? You know, in TLC, we were interested in getting the RF values. And so the RF values were kind of critical to knowing where the spots were. And in prep TLC, you don't need to know what the RF values are, essentially. In prep TLC, you've done a small TLC, you know what your RF values, you can measure the RF values within the prep TLC plate, which can help you to understand where you want to cut out, what sections it is that you want to cut out. So that can be helpful, but in general, no, you can actually visualize them a little bit better within the prep TLC, and we actually know what band it is we're trying to cut out. So that's the cool part about the prep TLC. Okay, so let's get rid of prep TLC.
I had a question about prep TLC.
Go for it.
You said that one of the problems with it is that it's such a big piece of glass.
Yeah.
Big beaker. Why is it that, why can't you have the size of the small TLC plates that we had and just have the thick coating on that?
What happens is you're using such a thick coating. Remember how the bands, as the bands go up the plate, they expand. And so if you do too big a spot, all the spots run into each other. Essentially, in order to get the spots to stop running into each other, you need a longer plate and you need more room for diffusion. So we use larger glass plates, and the smaller plates wouldn't really work as effectively because the spots don't separate enough on the smaller plates. You need a longer length in order to separate them. So we go to bigger pieces of glass, bigger plate glasses. And usually they're, like I said, they're like 8x8 or 10x10. And then you need a tank that can fit within. And at Cabrillo, we had a number of fish tanks that we used to use and put the prep TLC plates into the fish tanks. And the fish tanks were sort of these small little fish tanks. They were great. They were all glass. They had no seams. So they were perfect for what we were doing. There was no silicon sealant in it, like a fish tank would have. The problem with it was that Josh found them. And Josh loved to use them for his sodium demos, where he throws sodium metal into water and it fizzes around on top of the water. However, Josh always liked to get very excited with his demos, and he would throw large pieces of sodium in. The large pieces of sodium, pockets develop in the sodium as it starts to dissolve, and then water gets into those pockets, hydrogen builds in those pockets and heat, and then the whole thing explodes. He blew up 3 fish tanks. So we lost all 3 of our fish tanks to Josh's sodium demos. But yeah, anyway, you need a bigger fish tank in order to be able to do that. Okay, so that's the prep TLC. Let's start talking about columns. So in columns, when we do column chromatography, there are two names. We either call it column chromatography, or sometimes we call it flash chromatography. The flash chromatography is done under pressure. It's doing it faster. So what we do is we pressurize the column and we push the solvent through the column. Most of the time when we say column chromatography, we literally mean flash chromatography. It's almost always done under pressure because anytime you get any amount of sizable column, the flow rate through the column goes down so slow that it's unfeasible to do the column chromatography in a reasonable amount of time. So we generally pressurize the column with an inert gas like nitrogen or argon in order to increase the flow rate through the column. So that flash chromatography is pressurized. So usually column chromatography is flash chromatography. And the design of a standard column is that you have a solvent reservoir at the top of the column. And the solvent reservoir is dependent upon the size of the column itself. You then have the length of the column. And then the column usually narrows and goes through a stopcock so that you can control the flow. And then it usually has an angled lip on the end of the column. The reservoir that is up here can be all different sizes. These can be anywhere from 25 milliliters on up to 500 to 1,000 milliliters. In terms of the reservoir size of the bulb, the height of the column is another factor. So the height here can range anywhere from, let's say 6 inches, 6 to 10 inches, all the way up to like 20 inches or 24 inches. So these are just sort of standard sizes. The diameter of the column we usually do in millimeters. And the diameter of the column can range anywhere from 10 millimeters on up to like 100 millimeters. It just depends on the material that you're trying to chromatograph. And Pavia, in the back of Pavia, there's a great table that has the amount of material you're trying to separate in terms of grams. So down to a tenth of a gram on up to a gram, and they have them in stages. And then they tell you what size column you need, both the diameter and the height. And then they tell you how much packing material you need in terms of the grams of the solid support material that you're going to use to separate out. That's a great table within Pavia. And it's back in the appendix section at the end of the chapter. And that is a very useful that goes from grams of material to the diameter of the column, the height of the column, and the grams of solid support. So it's a great guide in based on how many grams of material you have, figuring out what size column you actually need to use in order to be able to adequately chromatograph the material. So what we would do is we would just measure the amount of material we want to chromatograph. We consult the table. We figure out what size column we need. We go and we grab the column, and then we start prepping the column. So the way that the column gets prepped, this is a pretty darn good picture. So I'm going to steal my column picture, and we're going to work with that. So this is packing and preparing column. There's a couple of different ways to pack columns. The method that I prefer is called the slurry pack method. The slurry pack method uses solid support material like alumina or silica gel. And you take it and you add the solvent to the silica gel in a beaker and you make a slurry out of it. And then you add it into the column. But because that material is so fine, what we need to do is a couple of things first in order to prep the column. The first thing that we do is we add in piece of cotton down in the bottom. And actually, you know what? I'm going to change colors so that we have sort of the cotton that goes in here. And that cotton material stops all of the solid support from going just through the column and getting stuck down in the stopcock, so that the material will actually stay put where it's supposed to be. Then the next thing that we do is we put a layer of sand inside here. And the sand is a clean sand material that its job is to make a flat layer. What happens is, if you're going to do like a sort of a zoom in picture, the cotton material, when you put the cotton material packing inside the column, is all uneven. And what we'd really like to have is we'd really like to have a very level base. And so what happens is, when we put the sand inside here, the sand fills all the nooks and crannies within the cotton, and then it makes a nice level top on which to put our next solid support material. So we put that sand in there to try to sort of level everything out and make it nice and even. The next thing that I do is I fill the column. So number one, we put in cotton. Number two, we put in sand. Number three, we fill the column with solvent. Whatever solvent we're going to use for chromatography, that solvent is the next thing that we put in there. So we fill with solvent. So now our column gets filled all the way up with solvent, and almost to the top, is about as high as I can get it. I fill it up with solvent. And then the next thing that we do is we make our slurry that we're going to use. So number four, we make the slurry. And we would weigh out our solid support material. We put it into a beaker. And once we put that solid support material in, then we pour solvent on top of it. And we make a solution. And the solution is a suspension, really. It's not homogeneous, it's heterogeneous. The solid support material does not dissolve in the solvent. It literally just forms a slurry. And the slurry makes it easier to add the slurry into the column itself. So once we make that slurry, one of the things that happens is, as you add the solvent to the solid support material, you get all these bubbles that start coming out. Some of the bubbles are trapped gas. Some of the bubbles are actually solvent that is boiling. That there is a very strong intermolecular attractive force when the solvent gets poured into the solid support material. It binds to the solid support material. Intermolecular attractive forces, you can think of hydrogen bonding, Lewis acid base interactions. All of those things generate heat. And as they generate heat, the solvent starts to boil right at the interface with the solid support material. On small scale, you almost don't see it. The heat diffuses so fast. But on large scale, you can really start to see it. And you need to let that heat disperse, and you need to let the solvent cool down before you can add that solvent to the column. And this is also why we do it as a slurry pack, because you can imagine that if I took the solid support material and put it in the column, and then I poured solvent through it, that all those gas bubbles, those trapped gas bubbles, would break loose, and the heat that is evolved would boil the solvent a little bit, and all those bubbles would carry up through the solid support material, and they would disrupt it, and they would create channels through it. And if you create channels through it, you're going to get an inhomogeneous solid support material, and you will get areas where the solvent can travel very fast and areas where the solvent can travel slow. And then you don't get good chromatography. You get mixtures coming out of the column rather than discrete bands coming out of the column. So the slurry pack method is easier to do, and it makes a better column. It makes a more homogeneous column. So that's why I prefer this method. So once we make that slurry, then the next thing that we do, we'll paste our column back in here again. Actually, I don't want that one. I'm going to get rid of that one. We're going to grab this one over here now because it's got our solid support material and our cotton. And then what we do is we put a waste container underneath the column. So we put a beaker underneath here, and we take that slurry that we've made and we pour the slurry into the column with the ground glass joint open, and we pour the slurry pack through, and it usually requires some type of spatula or something to drag the material out to get it, that's not a good arrow, to get it to go into the column. And so we drag it out into the column, and it sort of filters down. And as it filters down, it starts to pack. Let's go back to sort of like a gray color. It starts to pack in here into the column, and we keep that going, adding in the slurry pack and letting it all pack in until we get the column to the height that we want, until the column is all filled up. And at that point, we then take a device, sort of like a rubber tubing is a good, really good device to use. And we whack the rubber tubing up against the side of the column as this material is all sort of raining down and filtering down, so that it just packs in all nice and evenly. And we try to keep it so that when we get at the top of the column, that we get a nice even packing layer so that it's perfectly horizontal when it's all packed in there. And then we let the column set for a little bit. And then the column is packed, and we have clean solvent that has then flowed down into this container. This solvent can be recycled if we want, because it's clean. So we can use that solvent to actually run the column with. And now the column is entirely packed. Now it's time to load the column with our sample and then get ready to run the column. So we did, let's see, first cotton, second sand, three, fill with solvent, four, make the slurry, five, add slurry to column. And then now we're going to number six, load the column. So now we're going to do loading and running. So at this point, what we've got is we have a column that is packed. And I want to, usually I demo this and demo the whole packing process and show you what it looks like. Can't really do that. But one of the things that's really important to me in terms of learning how to work in a lab is knowing how everything is supposed to be clamped and set up. It's not just enough to know the theory, it's the practicality of how you actually do things. So let me show you a little bit more here. What we would typically do is have a ring stand that comes down, and we turn the base of the ring stand out back away from the column. And we usually clamp this with two clamps around the column. And the reason that we do that and do it this way in particular is because when we do column chromatography, we're generally set up, and I need to turn this one more direction. I'm going to paste it in one more time and show you from the back view why we do it this way. Because when this thing is clamped and the ring stand is at the back, and so going back away from us, we have sort of that base that's sitting in there. We use a large test tube rack, and the test tube rack is filled with a ton of test tubes. And when I mean a ton, I mean a ton. So test tube racks can hold 50 to 70 test tubes, and we're using smaller test tubes. And so this is an entire rack of test tubes that are in here. And what we want to do what's really important is to make sure that the base does not get in the way, the interference of the test tubes. So this is sort of an end-on view of the end of the test tubes. And what we want to make sure is that we can get to all of the test tubes and that the base doesn't get in the way of the test tube rack in all directions. So that test tube rack needs to go back and forth this direction, and it needs to go back and forth that direction, and you need to be able to access all of the test tubes. And so when you do column chromatography, you can't see when compounds are eluting off the column. The compounds are completely invisible. There's no way to visualize them. It's not like we can take them into the back room and use a black light on it and see when the compounds are coming off the column. So the only way to make sure that you are separating the different constituents in the mixture into different test tubes is to use a ton of test tubes. The more test tubes you use, the better the separation you're going to achieve. And that's the whole goal. So usually when we do a column, let's say that it's a column that is maybe chromatographing half a gram worth of material, and I've got a column that is probably 16 inches tall, I may do anywhere between 200 to 300 test tubes and then analyze all 200 to 300 test tubes when I do column chromatography. That's sort of what would have happened. So we set it up first, we get it all clamped, we make sure that that clamp is high enough, we make sure that the column is plumb, meaning that it's not leaning in any one direction. We want to make sure that it's plumb, that it's straight up and down, that it's vertical in all directions. And then once all that is in place and we have loaded in our material, now we actually load in the sample. So in loading in the sample, that's going to be step number, what, six? So in number six, we're going to load the sample. The sample is prepared in sometimes a round bottom, usually not a beaker, usually not even an Erlenmeyer flask. Usually it's coming out of something that you've isolated, like a round bottom. And there's a small amount of sample that's in this. And let's use... Oh, Finley is just going off today. I don't understand why he's cranky in there, but if I bring him in here, he's just going to be even louder. So I'm going to try to ignore him out there. He'll calm down in a minute. That's why we call him No-No. I don't know if I told you that Finley, our dog, his name that's used equally is No-No because he's just that bad. And he answers to No-No more than probably Finley. So, oh my God, dog. Give me 1 second. I apologize. Hang on. Okay, I figured it out. Finley's arch nemesis is leaf blowers. He hates leaf blowers. Leaf blowers are the enemy, and they should not exist. And they need to be barked at ruthlessly and chased away. So that's what was going on. There's a leaf blower somewhere in the neighborhood, and my dog just freaks out. Okay, we're back in business. And so in loading in the sample, what we need to do is we need to add the sample in as small an amount of volume as we possibly can. So you remember that when we did the TLC plates, one of the critical factors in doing the TLC plate was in keeping the spots small. That if a spot gets too big versus a small spot, as it goes up the plate, the spot spreads out. And we get bigger spots, and the spots can then bleed into each other. Whereas if we do a small spot, the small spot has a better chance of separating because it doesn't diffuse as much as a bigger spot. The same thing is true for a column chromatography, that if you put in a large amount of solvent with the sample, that large amount of solvent is akin to a large spot, and it will not separate as efficiently as if we put it in a minimum amount of solvent. So what we do is we use a minimum amount of solvent. And we try to keep the spot as small as possible as we load it in. And we use a pipette and just a pipette bulb. And we suck that material up. And then we use the long stem pipette to apply that solvent directly to the tip of the column. And we apply it in as narrow a band as we can. And we try not to disturb the upper layer. And then once that material is loaded in, oh, okay, back up. I forgot to do one thing down here. The solvent can't be that high. All right, I'm gonna skip down. I got distracted. I apologize. Okay. So we've got the loaded column with all of our packing material. Finley is still out there finding grounds people to bark at, gardeners with air blowers. We are preparing to load sample. And the first thing that we need to do into this is, number one, draw down the solvent. To top of solid support. The reason that we need to do this is very similar to, I'll show you another problem that happens. So we draw down the solvent right to the top of the solid support. Do not let the solvent dip into the solid support. Do not let solvent go below solid support. So this problem, if I were to take and apply the sample into, Caden, I saw that. If you were to try to take and apply the sample while the solvent was still high, the solvent would just dissolve all of your sample and it would be a big wide band. And we need to apply it in as narrow a band as we possibly can. So we need to drain the solvent down. That solvent needs to come all the way down to the top of the solid support before we load in the sample. Now we can load in the sample into this. So number one, we draw down. Number two, we load the sample. In as small an amount of solvent as possible. And then once that's loaded in, we load that sample in and it sits right at the top here. Then what we do is we draw down again. So we go through a series of drawing down. And we want to make sure that the sample that we have added gets pulled into the column before we add any more solvent to it. Okay, so we'll go to the next picture down here. We'll paste this in. We have our new material that we've loaded on. And what we do is we do a series of draw down, add solvent, draw down. So what are we on step here? This is 1, 2, 3. 3 is draw down. By draw down, what I mean is we are going to open the stopcock. We are going to have a waste container or our first test tube, whatever it is, and we open this and we drain out a little bit of solvent and we draw the solvent level down to the level of the solid support again, so that what winds up happening is it looks like this now. That material is now below the solid support. So this material has been drawn in. And then the next thing that we do is we add solvent and draw down again. So we go through this cycle and we do this cycle 3 times. So this is number 4. Add solvent, approximately like 1 mL, and draw down. And we repeat that like 3 or 4 cycles, times 3 or times 4. And ideally, what we're trying to do is we are trying to get to a point where the material now is sort of embedded down at this layer. And we have solvent that is sitting up in here. So I'm going to do that solvent sort of in blue so that we can track the light blue of the solvent like that. And my sample has now been drawn into the column. Now we're ready to run the column. Okay, so that whole process of adding solvent, drawing down, adding solvent, drawing down, is trying to prevent this problem. Let me ask you a question. So when we did TLC and you took your beaker for TLC, you had your TLC plate in there, your spotting line was, actually, let's do the plate this way. So the plate is sitting in here in the solvent. Here is your spotting line. Here are your spots. And your solvent in your TLC tank was up to here. And we've got the cover on the TLC plate. And this is a problem. When we develop the plate, do you guys remember what happens when we develop the plate? And this is set up this way. Does anybody want to unmute their microphone and throw me out an answer of what happens if I do it this way? If I lost everybody, maybe everybody's not even there. You guys have probably walked away. You're getting coffee.
Don't all of the solvents like mesh together because they're all dissolved into the liquid at the bottom?
Exactly. And so what happens is you get this band at the top, and the band at the top is all of the mixture of compounds because they've all traveled up together because they've diffused into the solvent. So all of these bled off and diffused into the solvent, and then they carried up the plate all in one big band so that at the top I got the big band that was sort of a washed out plate. That's what we call a washed out plate. Thank you, Sarah. You're paying attention. You saved me, Sarah. Thank you. The same thing happens to the column if we don't draw this down and get it into the column to start with. So that if we were to take and apply the material to the top and then fill that reservoir with solvent, all of the material that we just applied would have dissolved into the solvent and it would have looked like this. So I would have taken the column, the same problem would have happened, and we would have added solvent to it, and the material that we had applied up here in our nice narrow band would have diffused out and it would have just filled this entire thing, and then it would have gone in a very diffuse way in a ginormous band down the column, and we would have gotten no resolution down the column. So what would have happened is, as it went down the column, I would have had these big ginormous bands that would have overlapped with their different materials, and I would have had no resolution going through the column because they just all would have overlapped each other. That's why it's really critically important to be able to add in a small layer, as small as you can, draw it down into the solid support, add a small amount of solvent, 1 mil, draw that down, add solvent, draw that down, add solvent, draw that down, 3 or 4 times until the sample is embedded down in the column. Then we can move to actually running the column. So here, now what we've got is we have our material, which is embedded down here. We then fill the column with solvent. So now the column gets filled up with its reservoir. And now we run the column. The next thing that we would do if we were doing flash chromatography is we would attach our gas. So the gas fits into this with a stopcock. And there is an exit port. Think about the setup of this and how this actually works. Usually what we've got is a gas line that hooks to this. So we have a nitrogen line that goes into it, a stopcock that allows it to flow, but there's also a secondary little relief valve here that we can let gas out as well, so that the stopcock controls how much gas can go in versus how much gas can flow through. And we pressurize that column, and then we have all of our test tube banks sitting underneath this. And I'm just gonna do a sort of a simplified version of the test tubes. And what we do is we start collecting in the test tubes, and we collect uniformly in the test tubes, so that what we're doing is, this would be sample 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 ongoing, and we fill them all to the same height as the sample is eluting off the column. And then once we do that and we run through all the test tubes that we're going to run through, and we really have no idea how many test tubes we're going to run through. Usually, like I said, we run through anywhere from, could be 50 test tubes on up to 300 or 500 test tubes, depending on the size of the column. Then what we do is we analyze all those test tubes. So now we have a bank of test tubes that we're going to analyze. So where are we stepwise? I don't know, 4 or 5. Okay, so we can just analyze test tubes. In analyzing the test tubes, we go back to a, I forgot to look to see if there's any questions. Where we are. It was alumina that we were using in the column. But the columns can be alumina or it can be silica gel. Those are the two most common packing materials. There are other packing materials that can be used as well, but silica and alumina gel, silica gel and alumina are the two most common, and this experiment would have been done with alumina. Okay, so in analyzing the test tubes, let's say that we've got 100 test tubes to analyze. What we do is we take a TLC plate and we turn the TLC plate on its side. And we go through and we number we just create all of these different numbers representing the different numbers of test tubes. And we keep that going, however many test tubes we've got. And we do it all on one TLC plate. And then we go in and we place our spots onto the TLC plate. And we're spotting each tube without contaminating the tube. And we go through and we spot them all. And then once we spot them all, we don't develop the TLC plate. We just go and we view the TLC plate in the IR room using the UV light. And we look to see where there are spots and where there are not. So then we just view under UV, or sometimes stain it. And what we're looking for is we're literally looking for where compound shows up and where it doesn't. So what we see is that in looking at different compounds, we'll see that there will be spots in some tubes, and then in some tubes there will be no spots, and then in other areas we will get a different material coming through. Maybe a material coming through over here. And basically what we can do is, by doing this and looking at it under UV light, we can figure out where the contiguous blocks are that have different compounds that have come through. And those different compounds that are trapped within those test tubes, we take those test tubes and then we can analyze those test tubes individually by TLC, where we do develop the TLC. And we look at the margins and try to figure out where the test tubes are pure and where the test tubes have contaminants within them. So what we would do then at that point is we would take test tubes, and I might want to look at test tube number 3. So I'll mark test tubes that I'm curious about that I want to analyze. And I'm going to say, I want to look at test tube number 3. That is not the pin I chose to use. I want to look at test tube number 3. I want to look at test tube number 9 at the margins. I want to look at 13 and 16. I want to look at 19. And I want to look at whatever one this one is down here. And so then what I do is I take a TLC plate and I mark it out with those numbers. So I'll use a wide TLC plate. And I'll mark out that TLC plate with number 3 and number 9 and number 13 and number 16 and number 19 and whatever this number is here, let's call it like 25. And I spot those and then I develop it. And what I hope to see is that I hope to see that the compound that is in 3 and in 9 is going to travel the highest on the plate. And so I'm hoping to see that those are uncontaminated. 13 and 16 would have been the green color. So 13 and 16 wouldn't quite as travel as high because they came out of the column a little bit lower. 19 and 25 would have been down here. So this would have been ideal. This is what I would have wanted to see when I developed this, telling me that those blocks are uncontaminated. But what frequently happens is you will see cross-contamination such that I get a little bit of cross-contamination into some of these. And I might get a little bit of green in that blue one. I might get a little bit of blue into the green one. And the cross-contamination then tells me that I need to be careful of what tubes I'm actually selecting and condensing. And so I'll move in from my margins until I find the tubes that don't have any cross-contamination. And then once I find those tubes that don't have cross-contamination, I'll combine them like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I'll combine into a round bottom, rotovap it down, get that compound, isolate that compound. I'll do the same with like 14 and 15, rotovap those down together, get that compound. And in that way, I isolate all the compounds. So let me show you real quick kind of what this looks like. I had images. There we go. That I had, oh, this is from the other day. The other day where we did the chemical reaction with the fluorine, the fluorinone being converted to fluorinol. This was the chemical reaction that would have been tracked by TLC. This is the actual TLC plate from that experiment. And I don't have it in a way that I can mark it up, but the top compound is the fluorinone. The bottom compound is the fluorinol. You can see the fading out of the fluorinone and the fading in of the fluorinol. You can see the time frame down at the bottom there where I've got 0, 30, 60, 120, 240, and then the clear point. So that was that TLC plate. Here's a good TLC plate of what I'm talking about the analysis. So this is going all the way from 1 out to 66. And you can see this was not done on UV light. This was actually stained. and the different compounds stained different colors, allowing us to be able to see where the blocks changed so that I could tell which compounds were coming through the column at which times. And you can see that it took all the way until number 13 before material really started coming through, and that all the original first test tubes, 1 through 12, were almost empty. 13, the compound started coming through. There was an original compound that came through, 13, 14, 15. 16 starts to change color. 17, that color intensifies all the way through 26 and then starts to change around 30. And you can see that I put stars at like 28 and 30 and 43. Those stars were ones that I wanted them to investigate, to go through and to look at the TLC plate. And these are the TLC plates that are showing the cross-contamination within those, and us trying to figure out where the contiguous blocks were. And the compound that we were really interested in was the 31 through 40. And you can see that those are mostly pure. Those are the ones that we then rotovap down and were able to isolate. So this is just kind of showing you that technique of this TLC plate is my analysis plate, where I don't develop it. I just spot it and then look at it under UV light. And then I take those selected tubes that I'm really curious about, whether they're pure or not, and I run them through. Francisco, you have a question?
Yeah, I was just wondering why alumina or silica gel are used.
That's a great question. And if you look at Pavia, in Pavia, there's a table of all the different types of solid support, or the generally commonly used solid supports. We had sort of answered that question. Let me go back to here. Silica gel and alumina. Silica gel is SiO2. It's basically ground up glass, and alumina is Al2O3. These materials are very strong, strongly polar materials and strong Lewis acids. They don't dissolve in solvents. And that strong Lewis acid nature of them allows them to be very strongly adhering solid support materials for even slightly polar materials, which means that that the materials are going to adhere fairly strongly to the solid support. And that allows you to use slightly more polar solvents in order to do the chromatography. And these materials don't dissolve. They're just sort of ideal separation materials, because they give strong intermolecular attractive forces with most of the compounds that we're trying to chromatograph, which means that we can separate those compounds better based on their polarity. That's why we tend to use silica gel and alumina. There are other materials such as paper, cellulose, trying to think of some others. You can actually use Norbit or graphite. There are other solid support materials, but these are just super easy. And the alumina in particular, there is acid washed alumina, basic washed alumina, neutral alumina. There are different styles of alumina that will give you different types of separation. And also they're sold in different grits, so that you can get very fine alumina and very fine silica gel, and you can get very large granular as well. And those give different levels of separation. So with just these two materials, we have a large degree of tunability to create a solid support material that will separate whatever mixture it is that we're trying to separate. It's just, they're very, very flexible. I think that's why they're used the most. That's the best answer I've got for that.
Okay, and I was wondering, like, the last compound to come out, like,
yeah,
you colored it blue.
Yeah.
Would say that that's the most polar, because it would, the IMFs with the alumina would be the strongest?
Yeah, so what we've got there is we've got an elution order. And that elution order, hydrocarbons come out first. So let's do it this way. This will be first out is hydrocarbons. Things that are nonpolar. Aromatics come out next. And then you start getting into things that are slightly more polar. These could be things that are like ethers, esters. You get ketones, aldehydes come out up above that. Carboxylic acids, alcohols, then carboxylic acids. These are last out. And so basically what is going on here is that this is increasing polarity. And that increasing polarity means that they are going to be the last out of the column. They're going to adhere most strongly to the column. And so we have that increasing polarity and this elution order where hydrocarbons, aromatics, ethers, esters, all those materials come out before the more polar compounds. Yeah, good question. Anything else?
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Everybody else is good? Okay. So that's the column chromatography. That's how we would have gone through and done it, except for the fact that in order to do a column of this size, it's a really big undertaking. And we don't do the columns on that size. So what Pavia had you do was Pavia actually had you guys use a Pasteur pipette. And we used one of the long Pasteur pipettes. And then those pipettes taper. And they have the long tip on it. And what we did is in a Pasteur pipette, you have no ability to control the flow rate, which was problematic. And so what I instruct you guys to do is to take some rubber tubing and we apply some rubber tubing to the end of this guy. And then we use one of the pinch clamps and we put a pinch clamp across this. The pinch clamp gives you the ability to be able to stop the flow. And then what we did is we did everything else the same as before. We took and we put cotton in the bottom of it. Once cotton went in there, then we went in and we filled it with some sand and put a sand layer in it. And then we filled it with solvent and then we slurry packed it. And so once we slurry packed it, then we had our solid support material in here. And we left about an inch at the top for a solvent reservoir. We filled that with solvent. Actually, first we loaded our material, then filled it with solvent. So we would take in and we would put in our material there. This material is the fluorinone fluorine mixture. That was made for you. So there was a sample bottle of fluorine, fluorinone that was mixed in about 50-50 amount. And you were to use 0.30 milliliters of that mixture. That's how much we were chromatographing. And then you load that down into the column. And then we run the column with hexane. So the solvent that we were applying to this was a hexane solvent. And Pavia had this interesting instructions. What Pavia said to do was to set up four test tubes. And you were to collect into four test tubes. So the four test tube instructions, the first one was used for the setup waste. The second one was to collect the hexane fraction in. And then they had you switch to a 70-30 hexane acetone. And then the last one was the waste, just to run out the end of the column. And so they really only had you collecting in two columns. They had you collecting in columns 2 and columns 3 and trying to get all of the material separated into those two. And for me, that experiment has never worked really well. So instead, the way that I've designed the experiment is I would have switched it up and had you run about 6 different test tubes and not collect waste in the first or last, but to use all 6 to separate out the compounds, and then to take all 6 and spot them on a large TLC plate, and then to resolve them, to develop that TLC plate and to see how those samples actually separate. And let me see if I had an image of what that was supposed to look like. I don't think I do. I had a lot of TLC images, but those are all special projects, and I don't have any specifically for that experiment. But what it was supposed to look like when it was done, after you ran all 6 test tubes, the idea is that we would have had a plate that would have had samples 1 through 6. We would have developed in TLC, methylene chloride. And ideally what we would have seen is the two compounds that we're trying to separate out are fluorine, which was the colorless compound, and fluorinone, the ketone. And ideally what we would have seen is spots that would have maybe faded in 2, 3, doing them too high up there. Let's take these down a little bit. 2, 3 would have faded in a bit more, 4 would have had a bit in it. And then the yellow compound, the fluorinone, would have come out starting in 4, 5, and 6. I would have gotten a little bit in 4, a little bit more in 5, and a little bit more in 6. And that's what a typical plate would have looked like. That yellow color is not intense enough. Let's see if I can make it more intense by just building it up. Now, let's switch to something that's going to make it look more, make it so you can see it a little bit better. That's what would have happened. And within number 4, we would have had contamination. And so we would have like taken number 4 and we would have thrown that out. Instead, we would have taken 5 and 6 and grouped them together and rotovap them down. And 1, 2, and 3, grouped them together, rotovap them down. And we would have separated out the two compounds. We could have evaporated them, and then we could have taken the melting point of those two compounds and shown that they were two separate pure compounds. That would have been the entirety of the experiment. So that's where we would have gone. Let's see, what else do I need to tell you? I think that's about it, unless you guys have questions in terms of the column chromatography. No?
I had a question.
Yeah.
Just going back to why we use alumina. So in column chromatography, it seems like the adsorbent is the one causing the separation, whereas in thin layer, it was more of our choice in solvent. Is that correct?
No. It is the exact same as TLC. So the solvent is really what is causing your separation. It's a combination. You can't separate the two. It takes the solvent and the solid support both working in conjunction. Because remember that what's giving you the separation is the partition coefficient. So when we look at the partition coefficient, this is the concentration that is in the mobile phase divided by the concentration in the stationary phase. It's the interplay between the two. So it is, and the mobile phase is your solvent. And the stationary phase is your solid support. So it's the interplay between the two that is necessary in order to create resolution. It can't be just one or the other. So in TLC, it was both the solvent and the choice of solvent. We were locked into the solid support that we had at the time, which was silica gel. And so we played with solvent, but we could have easily done TLC plates of different solid supports and the same solvent and looked at how it would have resolved as well. It's the interplay between the two. The same is true for column chromatography. We can choose different solvents polarity in order to achieve or get better separation. So we don't always use the same solvent. We have to know exactly what solvent we would use. And in answer to that, we would use the same solvent that we would use in TLC for the column chromatography. In fact, that's how we find the solvent. So we don't practice a lot of small columns with different solvents in order to figure out what solvent's going to work best. We do all that work on TLC, and then we use the TLC as a model to figure out what solvent we're going to use for the column chromatography. So the interplay is exactly the same. That's a great question, Francisco.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Ying, you had a question, maybe? No? Or maybe my cursor's just sitting there, so it's floating around. Anybody else have a question? All right, so it looks like while I was freaking out with the dog, everybody was requiring the dog and wanting to see the dog. So hang on a second. I'll go grab Finley and Sadie, and we'll have a dog show. I'll be right back. Where are you guys? Come on, Finn. Where's Sadie?
What are you doing?
We're having a dog show. Everyone wants to see the dog. No, just the dogs, not the dog. Okay. Hang on, guys. All right. This is Finley, a.k.a. Bad Dog. No, no. This is Sadie. Sadie gets cold, so Sadie gets a sweater. Finley's jealous of the sweater. And my daughter is jealous of both dogs. So both dogs come in here to say hi. And my daughter is wondering why she doesn't get to come say hi. So, but no, it's all about the dogs, right? Yeah. So these are my guys. And they are not brother and sister. They are golden doodles. Finley is 3. Sadie is 2. And we think that they have a mother or father in common. They are from the same breeder, but they're not from the same litter. So we don't think that they have both the same parents. Finley's name, nickname is Nono. Sadie's nickname is Drumstick. That tells you a lot about Sadie. But she's sweet. She's such a sweet dog. She's just not a brainiac. Yeah. All right. What do you mean you can't see the dogs? Okay. I know what I need to do. Let me stop screen sharing. And if I stop the broadcast screen share. Oh, okay. Francisco's got a dog too. Cool. Okay. Can you guys see better now with the screen share off if I'm talking and these guys are up? Okay, cool. So
we're having a dog party.
Oh, it's a dog party. Yeah, all right. So everybody's got their pets. This is nice. My daughter just came in and flipped me off because I'm showing off the dogs and she doesn't get to come say hi. So that's pretty cool. All right. Yeah, dog parties are good. We need dog friends. They're good guys. All right, everyone. Let's see, what time is it? 10:12. That gives us about an hour before we go into lecture. And I think that's all I wanted to do today. Is that a cat? Who's got the cat? Everybody's got their pets. That's awesome. Finley can stay. He's all right.
Is he going to stay?
Yeah, he can stay. He's going to hang out with
me. Who's this dog right here?
I don't know. Dina, what's your dog's name?
Oh, my God. cute. Look at them all. Look, it's dog parties everywhere. Come here, come see the dogs.
Okay, I'm going
yeah.
to see the dogs.
Everybody's got their pets.
Look at the dog.
Oh my god, that's so cute.
I know. And there was a cat that was in there before. And oh yeah, we're all having fun. Oh, Sarah's got her cat. Nice, Sarah. Thank you. Yeah, you know, it's good to have a pet show at the end here. It makes it all worthwhile. It makes it fun. Yeah, it feels like a field trip.
That's so cute.
That's awesome. All right, you guys. So let's take a break. We'll get something to eat and something to drink. I'm going to have some tea, and then we'll see you back for lecture at 11:10. All right? Sound good? Thanks, everybody. See you in a bit.
Thank you.